Hello, welcome along to the Fun Kids Science Weekly podcast. My name's Dan. I've got something a little bit different for you this week. We're going out and about. We're taking the Fun Kids Science Weekly to the Watercress Line. It's a heritage railway in Hampshire, a county in the south of England. That means they run an old-school steam train line, the type you would have seen 100 or so years ago. They run it over a few stations, across 10 miles. Now, they don't just run the line and the stations, they also restore all the old trains that they use on it. So when you arrive in the yard, you see these huge engines that are being worked on, refurnished, the wheels are being fixed, are being bolted, are being cleaned, and we'll have a round, explore, we'll find out all about that. We also head into the workshop to chat to some of the workers who restore the boilers to make sure the trains actually get moving. Now, they're in the middle of restoring the Canadian Pacific, which is a massive, gigantic old steam train. It was originally built in 1914, was used during the Second World War, and it's one of the oldest and fastest surviving trains from that era. So we'll learn loads about that and about the project. We also head out to the signal box to have a look at how they actually control the different trains that move through the stations. Now, I was given a tour of the whole place by Dr. Becky, who was working on the project at the time, and we started out in the yard, where she showed me to a gigantic jet black beast of a train.
This is 506, and she is 99 years old. She'll be 100 next year. She was built in 1920 in Eastleigh Works, and she took 18 years to get back into service. So she came out of service on June this year.
Are there any features of a locomotive that's 99 years old that are perhaps light years ahead of something that would be 130 years old? What's remarkably more technologically advanced about this, where perhaps your older locomotives would lack?
I suppose size. The older ones were much smaller. This is quite a large steam engine. I suppose the biggest difference is between something that was built in 1920 and something that was built in the Second World War. So this has oil lamps that would have lit the way, yeah, kind of shown where the driver and fireman were going. They have no light on the cab, whereas a steam locomotive built in the Second World War, like a Canadian Pacific, she has a steam generator under her cab. And that powers electric lights. First locomotive ever to have electric lights, built in 1941. So she had electric lights that lit the way, and electric lights on the cab so the driver and fireman didn't fall over each other in the dead of night. So, yeah, it's kind of, I suppose, more of a bigger difference between those two eras than there are in terms of something built in 1920 and something that earlier, except for size.
This sounds like a really naive, stupid question. I'm looking at these massive, massive wheels that are here. Why did everything need to be so big? I guess, did the wheels need to be big simply because of the engines and the boilers that are powering this thing? Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to bear the load?
I was going to say, why not make something big? You can make something tiny. We've got miniature miniature engines that work perfectly fine with smaller wheels. The big wheels are driving wheels, so those are what power the locomotive. And each locomotive will have a different number, so not all of them have the same number. So this one has 6 driving wheels. We've got a 9F that has 10 driving wheels, and then you have 2 bogies, which is always a fun word to say. And those are what actually steer the engine round the corners. So sometimes you'll have 4 on the front, as we do here. So 4 small wheels on the front, 6 big driving wheels, and then it has absolutely nothing at the back. Whereas on Canadian Pacific, we have 4 small wheels at the front, 6 large driving wheels, and 2 small wheels at the back.
More about the bogies. So how do they help the train steer around corners? What are they doing?
So basically, they're held onto the engine's frames by a pin, and it allows them to pivot, and that allows them to steer the locomotive or the engine round the corners while the driving wheels power the engine as it goes, which obviously all of that power comes from boiling water like you do with a kettle, and using that steam, pushing it through pistons, and then that powers the wheels to go round. Obviously, the more wheels or more driving wheels that you have, in essence, the more power you have, but the power comes from the boiler. So our 9F that has 10 driving wheels is very powerful, and it was built to haul really large loads. So it was built to haul a load that's 13 times heavier than the space shuttle Endeavour. So if you think about that, that's if a space shuttle is big, and then she was built and designed to haul something 13 times heavier than a space shuttle, she was built to haul a big load. Whereas other steam engines were built only to haul passenger services. So they didn't need to be very big or very powerful. So we've got a tiny little tank engine, a bit like Thomas, and that can only pull three or four carriages. So it's not very big, it's not very powerful, it does what it needs to do. Whereas the bigger locomotives were built to haul passengers and freight at fast speed. So Canadian Pacific was expected to haul 600 tonnes at over 100 miles an hour. So yeah. She had to be big and powerful. But all that power comes from the boiler. The wheels are just what uses that okay. In order to turn them round.
So the real heart of driving a train is in the boiler room. Now, we'll head there in just a sec. First, I want to get some of the questions answered that you have left as a review on the Apple Podcast Store and sent over to funkidslive.com. This is from Lucy in Birmingham, who has asked whether trains use diesel or petrol fuel. Well, the trains, Lucy, that we're focusing on today are steam trains, so they're driven by coal. But quite a lot of the trains that are used at the moment are powered by electricity as well. And also diesel fuel, which in a litre has more energy than petrol does, so it's more efficient to power a train with. So that's mostly used when we're using quite an old-fashioned fuel source. Also, Victoria in Basingstoke has asked how the Japanese bullet train works. We've spoken about this, I think, before. They are maglev trains, which stands for magnetic levitation, and that's what they do. They use the idea of magnets that attract and repel. They use that to power it. So it lets the train float just above the rail a little, so there's very little resistance, so it can really fly. Then magnets are used along the line that switch poles. They flick between north and south, attracting and repelling to pull the train a little bit further down the line. Thank you so much for the questions. If you've got something sciencey that you want answered, you need to let me know what it is as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. Now, this week, we're focusing on steam trains. We're at the Watercress Heritage Railway line, and now we're going to head over to the boiler room where they get to make the trains. We'll also have a chat to a boiler smith, that is someone who gets their hands dirty and is vital in making the engines. So let's head inside there now with Dr. Becky.
This is where we restore our boilers, which is the heart of our steam engine. It's where we heat up the water to make steam and then use that to power the engine up and down the railway. And we've got some very different boilers in here at the moment. So we've got two different types. We've got a West Country class, which is called a Light Pacific, and she's called Swanage. And then we have our very, very big boiler, which is from a Merchant Navy class locomotive called Canadian Pacific. And these are made entirely out of steel. So normally on a steam engine, you have a steel outer boiler, and then inside you have a copper inner firebox, and that's where that fire sits. In these two, it's entirely steel, because they were both made in the Second World War, when particular types of metals were quite rare and you couldn't really use them. So they were made entirely out of steel, but they're really good producers of steam. So they produce steam very, very quickly.
Why is that? Why does one of these produce it better than something else that's not made out of steel?
So it's entirely down to the design of the boiler. So they have a really, really big firebox. So Canadian Pacific has a very large firebox. So she has lots of coal. So to kind of compare her to everything else, all of the other steam engines take 2 to 3 tons of coal a day in service. She will take 5 tons of coal. So really big. Very powerful, but she's got something really cool in her design. So that what sits in her inner firebox is something called a thermic siphon, and basically it's an additional way to push the water into the inner firebox. So in the inner firebox you have the fire that sits there. Around the outer of that inner firebox you have water, and then you have your outer firebox. So between the inner and outer is that where that water sits. Normally that's the only thing that gets heated is that water there. But for Canadian Pacific and Swanage, they have the thermic siphons which push the water directly into the inner firebox.
Right.
So that you heat more water more quickly, and it circulates it. So you're continuously heating water extremely quickly, producing steam very fast. So compared to a normal design, where it's only around the outside, it's only going to heat what's closest to the inner firebox.
At a basic level, how do you keep topping up the tank with water, or is it a case of the steam then cooling and it's just one long system?
So when, particularly for these types of locomotives, they have something called a tender, and the tender is what sits on the back of the engine, and it holds all the coal that it will need and it holds the water it needs. So what it then does is feeds the water from the tender into the boiler, so they can keep topping the boiler up as they go. Obviously, dependent on how many trips you might need to do, they might have to top it up. So they'll top it up from a water tower here at Ropley, and we use treated water. So we actually pre-treat our own water before it goes into the boilers, because what you don't want is, in some cases, like your kettle at home, you might get a bit furry, some limescale, and that limescale starts to eat the boiler away. So what we don't want is that happening. So by treating the water before it goes in, we don't get any limescale.
Right.
And so the boiler doesn't get eaten from the inside.
And when you're producing this massive steam, what's that lifting up that then drives the wheels at the most rudimentary level of steam train engines?
So the water's boiled, steam is produced, it's then pushed into, in the most kind of rudimentary way, into the pistons. That then moves things like the coupling rods, and that is what turns the wheels round. And so we're continuously pushing the steam through the system in order to make sure that the wheels go round. But how the steam engine moves and behaves is entirely down to the crew. So it's the poor fireman shoveling all of the coal into the inner firebox, and it's the driver using that steam effectively. How is he going to release that? Is he going to put more power into the system, a bit like an accelerator on a car, or does he need to slow down and things like that? So it's about them working together as a team, because they need to maintain the fire, use the steam appropriately, but also maintain water, because if they lose the water, then there's no need having a fire, really.
We're in the boiler room. Sam's a boiler smith here.
Boiler smith, yeah, yeah.
I just saw you heating something up. On my end, it was purposelessly, because then you walked away.
Yep.
What was going on from your end?
What I've just done there is preheated an area which I'm about to start welding. Obviously, any welding is putting an enormous amount of heat into an area. So by preheating it, you're just relieving some of the stress that's going to go into that area. So it's, when I start welding now, there's still going to be a lot of heat going into it, but the surrounding area, by already being hot, will become less stressed through the welding process, basically.
What will you be welding later on?
Literally just that area there, where there's that sort of V cut into those two plates.
So what are we looking at? So this looks like the back end of a locomotive. I'm happy to be proved wrong.
That is almost literally what we call it. We would call that the back head of the boiler. So the hole you can see there is where the coal would be shoveled into the firebox. And see where all the holes are, where there's this area with no holes in it. That is a new piece of plate inserted, where the old bit of plate was corroded. So what I'm doing basically is just welding that new bit of plate in. It will then be drilled for stays, and new stays will be put in that area.
And what stage are you at in making boilers, smithing the boilers for the Canada Pacific?
At this stage, we're building the new inner firebox for it. So there's some more plate work to be cut and tacked into place. Then there's probably going to be about 2 months worth of welding on the firebox. That's then got to be put into the main part of the boiler. Once that's in, there's probably about 2,500 stays to be drilled, tapped, fitted, corked. The heads are knocked over, so you have like a round sort of riveted head on the inside. So it's just a very, very long process, basically.
Now, we've heard how they restore and make the parts for the trains which go on the Heritage Line, but how do they control what's actually happening on the line? You see, the Watercress Line, it runs through Hampshire, a county in the south of England, from New Alresford to Alton, and moving trains through each station on the line is the job of the signal master. They have to be across where the train is, when it will get to their station, if it's safe to move through the stations when it arrives. Now, the signal master works in a little shed called a box. It's a little way down the line, and in front of him, if you can imagine, is this massive control unit full of levers and lights and maps and keys. And it turns out that the keys are actually incredibly important for keeping order. They're not proper keys, as you and I would imagine, like a key for your front door. This is something a little bit different and loads more special. They make sure that there aren't too many trains running towards the station at the same time, because if there's more than one train on the line in the station, that's a bad idea. Now, there's a lot of science in working this control panel, because you need to know your electricity and your circuits and how they work together, because it's not all digital. This is a heritage train line, all as it would be done in olden times, back in the day, when these steam trains would have been the way of getting around the UK. So there's a lot of science involved for the signalman who is in charge, and Dr. Becky took me up to see him, and as you can hear, I got just a little bit excited.
So we are a single track. The only passing points are at the stations. So you're only allowed one train in each section, otherwise you have a head-on collision.
And how far in advance do these need to be coordinated to make sure that that does not happen?
So we have this really cool system called a token system. So we have little keys for each section. And those keys are handed over to the driver, and only the driver with that key can enter that section. So we always know where the train is, because until it reaches the next station and they give it to that signalman, nothing else is allowed in that section. But we can have a look at the tokens. So these are the keys. So this is for the Rockley to Medstead section, and there's another one at the other end for the Rockley to Alresford section. So there are different types of keys for the different sections on the railway.
They're not like your key in a car. They don't go in the ignition key. The driver has to have one of those, and they go in one of those pages.
Okay.
And he has to have that before he goes onto the single line.
We're in the signal box right now, and traditionally, I'd imagine, in current trains, this is all done on probably one screen. In front of me, I can see, 30 of these pumps. Do you mind just talking to me about what they are?
Right, we've got several different colours. The red ones are signals. The black ones are points. And the blue ones lock the points in position.
How do you know at what point on the line a train is, so you need to work certain signals?
There's a current. The track isn't continuous electrically. It's divided into sections. When a train goes onto a section, it will short circuit and send that light will come on, and that will tell me it's in section D. It'll go on to E, that'll light, and all the way down there, and that will tell me exactly where the train is.
Now, this train line runs with a few stations that are working. Hundreds of years ago, when this type of thing was in operation across the country, how much of a signal master's job was it then to keep across which train are coming through London Waterloo, perhaps at that time, back in the mid-1900s, when you've got all these different signals happening? You're going to get something. You've got a clipboard.
You would have a clipboard. You'd have a working timetable. And that tells you when trains are due. Now, things can change, and that's when you would use the telephone.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's almost like modern technology has complicated quite a lot unnecessarily. Some things are so straightforward. How do we know where the train is? Well, you just pick up the phone, give someone a ring, and find out. So in this tour around a working heritage railway, we've been into the yard where the trains are kept, into the boiler room where they're built, into the signal box where they're controlled. Now it's time to climb onto the footplate, where trains are actually driven. Now, it's just as you would imagine it would be. I stood cramped at the front of this tiny train with two sweaty men who were volunteering. One would blow the whistle and control the throttle, speeding the train up or slowing it down. The other had a spade and soot all over his face as he was shoveling coal into the furnace. The coal fuels the fire, which makes the steam, which turns the wheels, which moves the train. So it's really the most important job on this heritage railway line. Now, when I was lucky enough to be on the footplate, the train was moving up an incredibly steep hill. The engine was doing just so much work to drag the carriages up an almost vertical wall, and that all meant that working there is a fantastically noisy job.
And with Pete in the footplate, he is the fireman, the coal shoveler. Sorry to dumb down your job, but that's essentially what you're doing. How much? Talk to me about the process of you, the art form of shoveling coal into the fire that's just there.
What you have to bear in mind is it's not just putting the coal on the fire, because although we'll probably use half a ton of coal in this trip, we've also used about 1,000 gallons of water. So I've got to keep my eye. Can you see the water level there?
I do.
So that's got to stay about there all the time. So if he's using 1,000 gallons of water, I'm also putting water into the boiler as well as shoveling the coal.
Now, it seems to me, I mentioned the art form just a second ago. Talk to me about how the subtle little differences and the skill in putting the coal in the right places to get the most efficient amount of energy from this footplate.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. It's a question of putting it in the right place. So basically the front of the fire, that's the area of the grate towards the front end of the engine, that's where you get a fairly quick response and the pressure on the pressure gauge up there will come round. So when you're stationary in the platform with sort of 15, 10, 5 minutes to go, you would build the back of the fire up. So I'd be putting coal into what we call the back corners on the left and the right, if you see what I mean,
yeah.
And under the door to get a sort of wedge shape. And then I'd put some, just before we get going, put some down the sides. So you get, if you can imagine, a sort of horseshoe. And then fairly soon after we get going, I'd then put the coal further forward. The crucial thing is to have the grate completely covered, but if you get a little hole in it, then obviously cold air rushes in and that has a disastrous effect on the pressure. But to answer your question about now, we're on a steep bit of railway line. It's a very steep railway line.
Well, they say that these are called the Alps.
Yes.
I mean, we're a fair old schlep away from France, Italy and Switzerland.
Yeah, it's all relative. But this is the highest railway station in the south of England. So in south of England terms, we're relatively high. And just round the corner, there's a sign that says Summit of the Alps.
Because it's... don't they say that the equivalent of getting a train up these hills is like a person summiting the Alps?
Yes, it is, because on the main network rail tracks, to them, a hill is a gradient of, say, 1 in 1,000.
Yeah.
Okay? We've just come up a gradient of 1 in 60, which for... I mean, we've only got 3 coaches on today, so we're not much more than sort of 120 tonnes or thereabouts. But if you're pulling 6 coaches up here with a train in excess of 200 tonnes, 1 in 60 is demanding. So, you know, the engine will have to be working hard. I will have to be working hard. So it is, it's really quite a climb.
And that is it for our tour of the Watercress Heritage Railway Line in Hampshire. Thank you so much to Dr. Becky and the rest of the team for showing me round. You can find out loads more about what they've got going on over at watercressline.co.uk. And remember, if you've got any sciencey questions that you want answered on the show, you need to leave it as a review for me so I can see it. 5 stars and everything. Remember to leave your name over on the Apple Podcast Store. While you're there, you can also find some of the brilliant science series that we usually do on the show. Loads on there. You can get them on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids are a children's radio station from the UK. You can hear us all over the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com.